Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud, as well as this concept, folks, that we need to continue covering the content. As a matter of fact, we're going to kind of discuss the content that we need to cover between now and the end of the year, because we're running out of time. And the most important content that we have to cover are the five critical documents. So we're going to dive into those coming out of the Whiskey Rebellion, which we actually have Sean here. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And so on top of that, folks, that's one of the reasons why we provide this content. Again, learn, pray, act, and it's all about compliance with the Constitution. These five critical documents, just so I can kind of give you a reason why this is so important, is because these are the documents that help everybody understand very specifically what and how we need to behave to reclaim our republic, to get our government back. So with that, I don't want to waste too much time, because what I want to do is get into the Whiskey Rebellion, kind of close up on this and kind of point out that even though we had covered how government went sideways, here was a point in time where the federal government was doing everything it could to operate within the Constitution. The only problem in this particular case was George Washington didn't want to marshal the militia into a federal army and just go storm over these rebel rousers who were just having a problem paying this whiskey tax. And so he delayed and delayed and took 2 years plus, or whatever it was, for him to finally say, okay, we got to stop this, because they've now marched upon Pittsburgh, which is where we kind of left off, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so now at this point, you know, they're kind of drunk in Pittsburgh. And meanwhile, what's been happening is Washington said, okay, you know, because this was a slow process. I mean, shoot, it took Sean less than a show to read, you know, all of that history. But believe me, folks, it did not take an hour for all of that stuff to play out. And so in the course of what it took for them to begin the march and to get to Pittsburgh as a large, I mean, that was a very large force. We're talking about thousands of men. And so, you know, the density of population, because back in those days, you had acres between houses. So off the top of your head, do you roughly know what an acre is, square feet?
No, sir.
I think it's 45,000 square feet. It's a pretty big plot of land, 1 acre. And so if you kind of look at a city block, I don't know if a city block is 100 by 100 acre, you know, what it is. But, I mean, 1 acre is a good chunk. I mean, it's shoot, if you come out, you would look at it as a store with a great parking lot. That's how big 1 acre is. Though in those days, they were buying plots. Now, were you a part of, I don't think you were a part of the reading of the content of how they divided the plots of land in Ohio, right? So this was the beginning of, you know, the expanse into Ohio, the territories where these men were. I believe that they were buying 600 and some odd acres at a time, or they were breaking those things down to be parceled out. So I'm just saying that the density to obtain just 5,000 men that you could pick up arms, or at least could, you know, grab, you know, supplies to kind of walk out and start marching and saying, sweetheart, you know, take care of the kids. I'm going to go take care of some business and be gone for a long time. This was a road trip. And not in the rebellious youth of today road trip, where they come back by the end of the night. This was a road trip that was a long time. I'm just trying to help everybody understand that, you know, while this march began, Washington got news, and basically that's when they quickly formed the militia and started heading that direction. Now, where these forces really met, I know history's probably wrote all of these things down. I'm not going to tell you that it's not relevant, but for what we need to cover, it's just not relevant. What's relevant is that out of the opportunity that the federal government could have done something, you know, wrong or different, they tried to follow. Congress actually tried to wait to call forth the militia in Washington, because they did. I think they originally called forth the militia, and Washington says, "Hold on, there. I'm not going to be marching these troops anywhere. What are you doing?" And so there was kind of like a, well, do we work for the executive, or does the executive work for us? Are we a represent? And at that point in time, because there was that much respect for Washington, hope everybody understands this, because there was that level of humility for this man who won the Revolutionary War, they didn't want to, you know, I'll just say disrespect him. Does that make sense, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So as Congress kind of figured out, okay, let's how can we do this so that we don't have to wait, the nation won't have to wait, because Congress isn't in session all the time. They were basically going on recesses, and for them to effectively call forth the militia, they needed to be in session. So what they did was they created a bill, or they made it possible to, you know, created the first part of we're calling forth the militia when the executive signs off on this. So they created a mechanism to allow the president to execute the Congress is calling forth the militia kind of thing. And so that way they could, you know, not have to worry about having to rush back in to do the business of the Union and still allow Washington this grace period, so that it doesn't make it look like, you know, anybody's dragging their feet. They're just taking care of business. So, you know, it's politics. This is, you know, this is the epitome of politics is the way I see this. But anyway, so at this point in the document that I'm going to post, this is basically just kind of a document that I kind of assembled from different sources. There's this little header that's called as an aside. So let's go through these bullet points one by one, and you can kind of read through all of these little details. So go ahead and let's take it off from here. Thank you.
In Section 8 of the Constitution, the power to call forth the militia was expressly given to Congress. But only 2 years into George Washington's presidency, the Second Congress temporarily delegated its authority under the First Militia Clause by passing a statute, quote, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, end quote. The Militia Act of 1792 was meant to be a three-year-long experiment, but gave the president broad powers to call out the militia. Section 1 of the act covered foreign invasions and imminent dangers from a foreign nation and met little resistance in Congress. On the other hand, Section 2, which dealt with suppressing insurrection, met with much resistance on the floor of Congress. After much debate, additional amendments were added requiring judicial intervention and that the president must first order the insurgents to disperse. 2 years after this act was passed, President Washington called forth the militia to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion.
Okay.
And what?
Okay, so now we understand the little bit of politics that went in. They wanted to be able to give the president the mechanism of the urgency of this, an invasion. And this concept of suppressing an insurrection, though, in this particular case, they wanted to make sure that there was some other checks or what have you. And technically, as it says here, this was a three-year experiment. But if you look at who was the president after this act, I believe, you know, I could be completely wrong here, but I believe that what happened is that they came back and they kind of created a permanency to this act to basically allow this new procedure to be followed, giving the president the ability to take care of the interest of the union, especially from an external threat like an invasion and so forth. So that's kind of how that was done. They did it in this act. So the next order, the next step, go ahead and read the next one then.
In Washington's sixth State of the Union address, he recounted the actions that he took. First, Washington followed the Constitution and the Militia Act by first seeking and receiving certification from the Supreme Court. Upon testimony of these facts, an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States notified to me that in the counties of Washington and Allegheny in Pennsylvania, laws of the United States were opposed and the execution thereof obstructed by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings or by the powers vested in the marshal of that district. Second, Washington issued a proclamation commanding the insurgents to disperse. I postponed, therefore, the summoning of the militia immediately into the field, but I required them to be held in readiness, that if my anxious endeavors to reclaim the deluded and to convince the malignant of their danger should be fruitless, military force might be prepared to act before the season should be too far advanced.
Okay, so you like this choice of words?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Quite diplomatic.
Yeah, okay. All right, so keep going. I'm sorry.
My proclamation of the 7th August last, 1794, August 7th, was accordingly issued and accompanied by the appointment of commissioners who were charged to repair to the scene of insurrection. Finally, the president assembles the militia to quell the rebellion. Thus, the painful alternative could not be discarded. I ordered the militia to march after once more admonishing the insurgents in my proclamation of the 25th of September last. Washington was distraught that military force had to be used against his own countrymen, but he was very happy to report that the rebellion was over. The event itself was disgraceful and required a significant portion of the country's resources, but it proved that our prosperity rested on a solid foundation of citizens who understood the true principles of liberty. While there is cause to lament that occurrences of this nature should have disgraced the name or interrupted the tranquility of any part of our community, or should have diverted to a new application any portion of the public resources, they are not wanting real and substantial consolations for the misfortune. It is demonstrated that our prosperity rests on solid foundations by furnishing an additional that my fellow citizens understand the true principles of government and liberty, that they feel their inseparable union, that notwithstanding all the devices which have been used to sway them from their interests and duty, they are not as ready to maintain the authority of the laws against licentious invasions as they were to defend their rights against usurpation.
Okay.
Commander-in-Chief, go ahead.
So he's sending this message out, and I think he's doing a pretty good job playing a politician here. And I think that he kind of laid out the importance of the union. But was there anything that you said that might have created a little bit of bitter taste in your mouth? Okay.
Inseparable union.
There you go. See, you did get it. There you go. So he actually laid this out as if the union itself was inseparable. In other words, once you came into the union, you couldn't leave. Now, again, Washington, not being a man of law, not being a man of understanding compacts and so forth, he must have missed during the Constitutional Convention. He wasn't attending the ratification base. He wasn't there. Nor did he probably really read the Federalist Papers when they got into these legalities that If a compact is being violated, in other words, what he's talking about, they were inseparable because the union was being operated in line with the Constitution. But when the union is then being operated outside the context of the Constitution, like what Lincoln did, Lincoln actually dismissed the militia and created the first mercenary force of the Union. Most people don't know that. The militia was not going to act the way Lincoln wanted them. He wanted them to, you know, be vigorous in going after these separatists that left the Union. He wanted them to attack and force them back, and they got repelled. I mean, they they couldn't win. He wasn't getting what he wanted out of the first few months. He dismissed the militia, and then went forth in creating an army, which is when Taney basically told him, "You're violating the Constitution." And where Lincoln just basically with a big grin, looking down on this little man, Roger Taney, the Chief Justice, and said, "I'd like to see you enforce that." So, I mean, words of a tyrant. So anyway, because we just covered this, I wanted to make sure that it, you know, you noticed it. And great, you did. You noticed that there was this, you know, it's not that it was not, you know, flaming incorrect, but it could be construed as a paradigm that the union itself was inseparable. That when the government is functioning within the boundaries, within the framework, in a constitutional manner, states do not have the option to leave the union. It is only when the federal government is violating the Constitution, because of the violations, they can leave the union. And that's one of the reasons why we're picking up the next content when we're done with this. Okay, so now keep going with the Commander-in-Chief and so forth. Thanks.
Commander-in-Chief George Washington could not have been prouder of the militiamen that he called forth and marched 300 miles to Pennsylvania. It has been a spectacle displaying to the highest advantage of Republican government to behold the most and the least wealthy of our citizens standing in the same ranks as private soldiers, preeminently distinguished by being the Army of the Constitution, undeterred by a march of 300 miles over rugged mountains, by approach of an inclement season, or by any other discouragement. Washington was also proud and wanted to thank the patriotic support he received from the governors. Nor ought I to omit to acknowledge the efficacious and patriotic cooperation which I have experienced from the chief magistrates of the states to which my requisitions have been addressed.
Okay, so hold on here. Who was he referring to as chief magistrates? This is another old British paradigm. But who was he referring to? Because today
governors?
Governors, correct. Now, it didn't take much to create that connection in what he was said earlier and then actually said it. But today, who do we call magistrates today?
Judges.
Yep. You see? See how everything's... We now have a judiciary form of government. So, okay, instead of the monarchical form of government or the executive, that was the older paradigm. Here, we now have completely perverted this concept of magistrate being judges. So, go ahead. Keep going.
Above all, he wanted to give praise to every citizen of America for their affection and vigilant support of the Constitution. To every description of citizens, let praise be given, but let them persevere in their affectionate vigilance over that precious depository of American happiness, the Constitution of the United States. Let them cherish it, too, for the sake of those who, from every clime, are daily seeking a dwelling in our land.
Right there.
And when all is...
Okay. So, thank you. So, I'm going to reread this, because I want to make sure the paradigm in supporting government is not supporting governments. To every description of citizens, let praise be given, but let them preserve in their affection, in their affectionate vigilance over that precious depository of American happiness, the Constitution of the United States. Let them cherish it, too, for the sake of those who, from every clime, are daily seeking a dwelling in our land. In other words, he just gave full creds to the Constitution, not the U.S. government, not to himself, not to the militia, to the Constitution. I just wanted to highlight this because we are all obligated, by this point in time, the obligation of citizens as you were naturalized, you were taking an oath to support the Constitution. The concept of supporting the Constitution against enemies foreign and domestic quickly came into play as a duty and obligation of all citizens to be willing to take up arms to do just what they had to do then. The militia was then composed of, or I should say the states were then composed of militias with laws that would then require the compulsion of men to take up arms to support the Constitution, not the president, not the party, not an office, the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. So I think I've dragged the dead horse effectively, and so let's continue.
When all was said and done, he hoped they would realize that this insurrection was based upon ignorance and false accusations of their government. And when in the calm moments of reflection, they shall have retraced the origin and progress of the insurrection, let them determine whether it has not been fomented by combinations of men who, careless of consequences and disregarding the unerring truth that those who rouse cannot always appease a civil convulsion, have disseminated from an ignorance or perversion of facts, suspicions, jealousies, and accusations of the whole government.
Okay, keep going, keep going.
Now it was time for Congress to amend the laws and make the Militia Act of 1792 permanent. What better and more honorable way was there for Congress to thank the citizens of America than to give the president full and lasting power to call forth the militia to suppress insurrections and repel invasions? Having thus fulfilled the engagement which I took when I entered into office, to the best of my ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, on you, gentlemen, and the people by whom you are deputed, I rely for support. In the arrangement to which the possibility of a similar contingency will naturally draw your attention, it ought not to be forgotten that the militia laws have exhibited such striking defects as could not have been supplied by the zeal of our citizens. Besides the extraordinary expense and waste, which are not the least of the defects, every appeal to those laws is attended with a doubt on its success. The devising and establishing of a well-regulated militia would be a genuine source of legislative honor and a perfect title to public gratitude. I therefore entertain a hope that the present session will not pass without carrying to its full energy the power of organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and thus providing, in the language of the Constitution, for calling them forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
Okay, so what do you think he was really kind of talking about?
He was like, next time, y'all better have things set up better than this so we can squash things when they pop up.
Right. So, as I've been saying, with this brand new government, and we're going into break, so I guess we couldn't have timed that better. So, I will reemphasize what I've been saying when we come back from break, because the Constitution laid out checks and balances to ensure that we, the people, could keep them from waging tyranny because they had to use us. We had to be willing to be participants. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I had been saying for the longest time, that when we formed the union and came together, even though we had peace somewhat, we had huge debts to pay. We had focused on a very hostile, an empire of the world maintaining hostility towards us. They were capturing our commerce and impressing our soldiers and stealing our ships. And so, you know, they had the same conditions we did when we had to fight the Revolutionary War, which means that, you know, it was by happen chance. You really had to have a large, you know, fleet of ships out there looking for these, you know, ones and two ships carrying commerce coming from the United States. And so therefore, when, you know, you're out there looking, you know, to cover that immense ocean, I mean, you just had to be in the right place at the right time. And anything that may have happened, you know, passing in the night, hey, unless you ran into each other, you'd never know, practically. So keeping in mind, all of these things were in play. There were active hostilities. It wasn't as successful and as aggressive as it could be with proper technology we have today, proper munitions and so forth. But it was still a level of hostility. In addition to the latency of being effective with your responses. In other words, it took months to respond to something. We didn't hear about what happened in Tripoli until about a month later. And then as soon as we found out, it took about a month to respond, and Jefferson didn't waste any time. So, you know, what they were dealing with were the dynamics of life in their day. So they didn't have, at that point in time, the ability to focus their money in building up the militia. And as a matter of fact, we were coming close to the end of Washington's term. You set it up here in how many states of the Union. In Washington's sixth State of the Union address, so this was the sixth, right? So what do you call the first address? The inaugural, right? And so this was coming close to the end of his second term. Does that make sense? Are you following me on this? So basically, the sixth State of the Union was the seventh year of his service. He had one more year after this, one more State of the Union to do the seventh. So Washington, I mean, there was probably the latitude that Washington could easily serve a third term. And I don't think he survived the duration of the following 4 years. I believe he died before Jefferson went into office. He died during Adams' term. And so as you look at, you know, what Washington was asking for, and all of a sudden, you know, him leaving, they still didn't get things moving to where they created a system. And what I mean by a system where the federal government has this responsibility of arming, equipping, and training. So that means that the federal government, the War Department, needed to actually start spending money on buying arms to hand out to the militia. And armament, you know, any defensive armaments or, you know, the ammo for training, those types of things. So as we kind of look at this, you know, this situation that Washington's talking about, it was going to take time. I know he wanted the legislation to be done, but what it seemed to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, Sean, it seemed to me what he was really looking for was an amendment to the Constitution to give the executive the authority to call forth the militia as a permanent solution. Do you see that, or do you think that that was, you know, one of those things?
I was thinking that he was trying to get Congress to pass some laws that would cover it.
Okay.
I never thought amendment, but that makes sense.
Yeah, because the Constitution, being a Republican form of government, the duty and responsibility was clearly delegated to Congress to determine whether the executive would need to, you know, play in, you know, army games or military games, war. And so I think what he was looking for was a, you know, because he talked about the ineffectiveness of what it took to get the army ready to, you know, and deployed. And he was pretty proud of the fact of what they were able to do. But you got to remember that it had only been 10 years, 15 years about that since they kind of went to peace. So there were still plenty of people that remembered the marches and remembered the fighting ways of the Revolutionary War. But there were probably lots of young kids that, you know, hey, what are we going to expect? What's going to happen? You know what I mean? They're just lacking any experience, and they're looking to the guys that had gone through it. And these guys were, oh, it's going to be bad. It's going to be tough. You might die. You know how, you know, old farts are, or I should say the old salty ones. Yeah, you're one of those candidates that will probably die first. Anyway.
But looking back at it, he does say in the language of the Constitution.
Yes, yes. And so using that term, I think that's where he was really looking for a amendment to basically change that.
Yeah.
Right. So that language would provide the type of legislation that would allow him to do those things. So that being said, the fact is the amendment never came. What Congress decided to do was they decided to create a permanency in this procedure for the president to bypass them for imminent danger and those types of things. As far as I'm concerned, folks, that absolutely requires an amendment. Not that I would have any hesitation that the president could not act if it was in America's best interest. But this is where the states need to step in into that amendment process and say, this is what we would qualify as our best interest, not what you would qualify as our best interest. Does that make sense? Probably not.
The first thing I think of is when Texas was trying to enforce the immigration laws, and the courts were telling them they couldn't do this and they couldn't do that. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, okay, so what Texas didn't do was Texas never challenged the federal government's usurpation of immigration laws and the fact that they have been regulating immigration as if they own it in the Constitution. What Texas should have done was say, near as we can tell, there is no enumeration in the Constitution for you to create laws regarding immigration. Why didn't Texas do that? I'll tell you why. Because all of a sudden, it would open up the door to where some of these progressive states might be able to actually start taking latitude. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because they're going to say, well, if you can do stuff to keep them out and it's a state's right thing, then we can do whatever we want to bring them in.
Right. And so what would have to happen is each of the states...
They're doing that anyway.
what each of the states would need to do is all of the conservative states would then have to deploy a militia on all roads connecting to those states with their state. Does that make sense? And creating, you know, like the states that are very close to those extreme western states that are, you know, sanctuary states, those states that are just red next to them, I'll give you a case in point, Idaho. Idaho would have to actually have a port of entry on every road that would be connecting to the state of Washington and Oregon to ensure that nobody was coming from that state that was an invader getting into their state. Now, this is where Article 4 of the Constitution steps in. Article 4 guarantees to every state in the Union a republican form of government and shall protect each from an invasion. So this is where the states could actually go back to the U.S. government and say, we've got our militias deployed. We need funding to maintain this protection from these states that are allowing the invasion to occur. And even though the invasion, because what would have to happen for this world, really, if you peel it back, the states would have to establish a agreed upon system of entry for immigration. This is where the progressive states would just try to avoid getting on board with anything and just opening up their doors and just letting mayhem, kind of chaos, rule the day. All of the other states in the Union would basically say, oh, okay, so we have this responsibility. We need to lay it out. And they could easily pass an amendment to create that system necessary. Because how many states would we need to be able to do that? We would need 38 states to amend the Constitution, which means that they would have to have, you know, 13 states to keep us from doing that.
That's right.
Okay. And so I honestly think we could easily get there. I honestly think that we could actually pass an amendment to create a very secure system where the states would basically manage their own immigration. And then as they do that, the states would then basically have the federal government would have a repository where they would submit, you know, the documents and so forth of the people that would be coming to the ports of entry, because then those people would be allowed in as immigrants because the states control that. They would have to have documentation, though, because the federal government has the responsibility of controlling the border to ensure that nobody crosses that line that doesn't have proper access. That makes sense, right?
Yeah. Oh, how does that, how do you reconcile the, I don't remember exactly where it was, where one, all the states share information, or what was it? I'm not sure. Let me pull up the Constitution.
Okay.
But I was thinking the Fourth Amendment. If you're going from one state to another, did they have the right to search you and question you about, you know, your identity and things like that?
Yeah, if you were a citizen, if you were a U.S. citizen, you could go from state to state, no problem. If you were a state citizen, because Washington and California could actually allow these people to become states, these invaders, to become citizens of that state. But they don't have a right to travel throughout the United States until they're citizens. And the uniform code, or I should say, an uniform rule of naturalization, lays out that they have to actually be immigrants. In other words, the laws currently state that a person to be qualified to be an immigrant, you can't be an invader. What they've done is they've created DACA. They've created these blankets that, oh, we've got so many people, we're just going to, you know, okay, you fooled us, And when you've been fooling us for, you know, decades and decades and decades, and we're still idiots because we haven't learned our lesson, and we're going to create another blanketed clause to allow this group of people direct access to citizenship. Well, that violates the law. The law is a uniform rule of naturalization, and it's very specific in there. This is what it takes.
Okay, go ahead. Article 4, Section 1. And if a person is a citizen of a state but not a citizen of the United States, how does that work?
Well, so if they're a citizen of the state but they're actually an invader, then the states would actually have to protect themselves to say, hey, that person that you have here is not a true citizen of the state. It's an invader, somebody that got into the state because the, you know, they snuck across the line. So that would have, that it would require, because of the way the system has been completely perverted by the federal government, the states would literally need to get the federal government to clean up and have a very clean and concise procedure. It's not something that exists, but it's not something that is rocket science. We have a responsibility of protecting our culture and protecting our government and protecting our liberties by ensuring that invaders get repelled, that they're not allowed to stay. Or amend the Constitution to say America is everybody's land and nobody's land. Whatever. Right? I mean, you know, to get existential.
That's it.
The point is that what we want to do is we want to be very clean and concise so that everybody understands what the process is and we abide by it. We're not abiding by the law. The federal government has assumed unconstitutional controls, so they're creating laws as they go along. And they've been able to weaponize this entire process to use it against us, to destabilize us. We're being destabilized by our own government.
Yes, sir.
And this should just get this should be getting everybody hot and bothered. But the fact is, it's immigration. These are undocumented immigrants. No, to be an immigrant, you have to enter into a port of entry as an acknowledged immigrant coming to this nation with authority. These people are coming here without authority, coming across the line without going through a port of entry and saying, okay, I'm here. That, by the Constitution and by the foundation of trespassing laws, invader laws, that is an invader or a trespasser. It is a law violator. It is not somebody that is an undocumented immigrant.
Being an illegal immigrant doesn't make you a criminal.
So actually, by definition, if you're an illegal immigrant, you are a trespasser. If you're trespassing, that means that you are committing a crime,
and that means that you're a criminal.
There you go. That's right. So anyway, all right, so
it's like you said, it's not rocket science.
Right.
My question would be about the federal government's responsibility via the Constitution to protect the country from invasion. So if they give each state their own, if the states have the right to immigrate anybody they want, then they could be facilitating an invasion and say, oh, that's states' rights. So how can the government enforce and secure the nation, the union, if the states are allowed to bring in anybody they want? In line with the conversation that you were talking about.
Okay, so we actually talked about this when we went through the Constitution as well with foreign trade. The federal government has the ability to set the international affairs, not just the federal government, the president. So when we get the next president in, like Biden. Biden can say, well, our enemies are our friends and our friends are our enemies now, right? Good is evil and evil is good. And so he can turn around. This is why we have to be very careful when we elect a president, because they can actually start opening the doors to our enemies. But the president actually dictates what nations we will call friendly and trade with and what nations we won't. Congress doesn't have that power. They have the power to regulate that commerce coming in from those nations that the president feels okay with. Does that make sense? And the president has to get the Senate 2/3 of a majority when creating treaties regarding trade with nations. If it is a hostile nation that's been hostile with us for a long time, then it would require, you know, that treaty, if it's going to be a first-time trade agreement, we have to set it up as a treaty, right? And that's where Congress steps in. Basically, the Senate would then go through the treaty. Now, that treaty should be pretty, you know, protective of our sovereignty and rights with this, what we were considering a hostile nation. Now, with this new communist or this new evil, you know, president who now wants to, you know, open up our doors and make us vulnerable, our protection is the Senate in negotiating that treaty. They have to get 2/3 of the Senate to agree upon that treaty. But the president is the one that opens the doors and closes the doors based on whatever, you know, that strategy is. And so we've actually seen, you know, in the changing of presidents, a change in the temperament in dealing with other nations. Now, a lot of globalists have kind of poked us in the eye to say, ah, that's a problem with your system. You need to maintain a consistency. Well, they want a consistency that favors them, not a consistency that favors us. So anyway, I think the big point here is that the president actually has, you know, and does set the tone when it comes to foreign relations. That is delegated to him, not to Congress. Congress basically works out the regulating of the trade with those nations that are favorable, that the president feels that are favorable with us. Washington tried to establish a free trade with all nations, but it was shortly after that where we started realizing that it wasn't free trade, because what was ended up happening was these nations were placing imposts on what they were sending us, and so, or what we were sending them. And so in turn, we placed imposts and tariffs and those types of things to counter what they were doing. Now, there are plenty of people that argue on, you know, the theoretical free trade. It's a great thing. A truly free trade system is a great thing. But there is none. There's no nation out there that doesn't have protectionisms right now. And it doesn't make it a good policy for us to not have our own protections against all nations that are protecting themselves. We should be trying to lead people and encouraging them to establish a true free trade. But just because they want to add 30% taxes on the crap they're sending us, then we need to do the same thing by laying imposts on that crap so that it makes it harder for us, or the desirability of our buying their crap goes down significantly. Here's the real problem. Today in our paradigm, everybody believes it's okay for foreign businesses to come to America, create a factory, and build and make product here in America. The Constitution does not allow that. It does not allow our own corporations to travel abroad and produce and then ship that crap back to us as if it's our own product. That would be foreign trade. Imposts would be placed upon it. And these, the United States corporations, which were really the leaders of globalism in working with the world banking system and other corporations, these other outliers. I mean, the United States was this huge, I'll just say, an army of massive corporations, because we had the advantage. We had the advantage over the last century of establishing these great world-dominating corporations. So bottom line, we see how we've completely started opening our arms to foreign involvement in America, to foreign ownership in America, and it is clearly all unconstitutional. Anyway, I will stop myself there. We've still got a few things to read Go ahead, yeah.
No, I was going to say it's crazy because we developed an attitude and a mentality in the country that the materialism is somehow a sign of prosperity. And that's, a lot of people blame capitalism for that, but I don't see it that way. It's about the market controls that. Okay. So if we didn't have the desire for all this crap, as you call it, then we wouldn't be in this situation. We wouldn't have China with a stranglehold on trade and all the manufacturing, you know, of all the things that we need and the crap that we don't need.
Right. And this all has everything to do with our government actually going to bed with corporations and basically creating partnerships and permitting and help bolstering American global corporations to become big and strong. And then once they created this boardroom of massive strong corporations, well, all of a sudden, what was the pushback from the globalists of the world? It was banking. It was the Rothschilds and banking. They had to push back. Oh, look at the Americans! They're taking over corporations. They're dominating all trade. And so they said, okay, if you're going to have these corporations that are going to be stripping us, we're going to have banking that's going to keep you in check. And this became the beginning of the next level of compromise of the globalist agenda. And so as we did that, then all of a sudden nations started literally falling into communism. The Bolshevik Revolution came after the Fed. And we started seeing nations falling to communism, and those nations became literally, people sitting at the altar of power coming in and actually becoming a part of this. And look at today. All the corporations that have gone into China, all great American corporations, we have allowed them to steal our technology. We bolstered them, and they now are in a position of superiority, but they have a strong strategic position to basically have great leverage over us that they should never have had. Had it not been for Nixon and this globalist agenda, blah, 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 blah. We're out of time, but actually what we're going to do to kind of, you know, to move forward from this, because we still have a little bit left to do on the Whiskey Rebellion. What I want to do is I want to take a pause and go through the song Jerusalem. I already went through this before. I think it's a great time to pick this up. I'll bring this in. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.